on the topic of the mystery of cosmological constants, evidence for the existence of God. Did I get that right? Okay. And, okay, Walter Bradley comes to us from the South, as you'll hear soon. He's a lovely Southern accent, which is, I enjoy. He received his bachelor's in engineering science and his PhD in materials science from the University of Texas in Austin. Taught for 8 years at the Colorado School of Mines, 24 years as professor of mechanical engineering at Texas A&M University. And then he spent his final years as a professor at Baylor University as distinguished professor of mechanical engineering. He retired a couple of years ago and is still active in doing some consulting work related to the use of underutilization of coconuts, of all things, for all kinds of purposes. And I've actually experienced a minute or two of how much you know about coconuts. And it's a wonderful topic, actually, a very unusual fruit. So during his years, he received many awards, research grants, published many technical articles, book chapters, and he is a fellow of the American Society for Materials and American Scientific Affiliation. And yes, so please welcome Dr. Bradley as he leads us with our opening talk. Thank you.
Yes, it is, and being in a big city like Boston where you have 1,000 different opportunities, thanks for sharing the evening with us, Randy, and I will hopefully be able to make it worth your while, and hopefully we'll all learn something. As I've said at the other two evenings, my goal tonight is not to persuade you of anything, but hopefully to stimulate a good conversation when we have a Q&A. Randy and I agree on a lot of things, but we don't agree on everything, and you'll see that will come out in our conversation. But again, one of our goals for the evening is for us to all be able to disagree, but not be disagreeable, okay? So, and as Christians, that shouldn't be difficult. Notice I changed my title just a little bit because the title was really to describe what we're doing as the program, but my part of it is really talking about fine-tuning evidence for, but not proof of, the existence of God. And then Randy's going to take a slightly different turn. Interesting how many books are being published today on fine-tuning. If you look around, it seems like there's a new one coming out almost every year, and a lot of them written by some of the major people in cosmology and astronomy in the field. Question is, why is this the case? I think there are at least two reasons that this has become such a topic for popular scientific books as well as more technical ones. Is that it addresses what is considered to be one of the great current mysteries of the universe that has developed as we have come to learn more and more about the intricacies of the universe and what's required to have life. A second reason is that it's a question or a topic that is pregnant with all kinds of metaphysical implications. And so I think obviously this creates a much broader interest than people who are just strictly in science. And so I think interesting people like Stephen Hawking, for example, allude to this in multiple ways. Stephen Hawking says even atheists like Stephen Hawking know that it is difficult to discuss the beginning of the universe without mentioning the concept of God. My work on the origin of the universe is on the borderline between religion and science. He goes on to say, and I'm not exactly on the border, though. I'm actually on more of the science side. But he acknowledges that the work he's doing certainly has religious implications as well. As an atheist, he certainly thinks that work supports some of the kinds of metaphysical positions that he has, but it's interesting that many of the people that work in this field are interested not only in the science itself, but in the metaphysical implications. Way back as far as 1992, there was a cover story in December of that year for Time magazine saying, "What does science tell us about God?" I don't think an article like this could have been written in 1950, because the answer would have maybe been, well, not much. But in fact, by 1992, a lot of the things I'm going to be speaking about today were developing and creating a rather interesting enigma that raised all kinds of interesting questions. Newsweek, interestingly enough, ran a similar article in 1997, and several other of the mainstream magazines had done similar kinds of articles. So the interest is really mainstream, not just in some little corner of interested people like us at ASA. Some examples of the recent books that have been written, and many of these by rather well-known scientists. One that we used for our reading, I think, Randy, since you had a homework assignment, how many of you actually did your homework assignment? Okay, see, I was afraid of that. But that's okay, I'm not counting on it. I prepared my talk on the assumption that most of you are busy and you worked all week and you would not have read something before Friday night. But let me encourage you, after we finish the evening and you have some time maybe over the weekend before it slips your mind, read these two articles. They're really book chapters. Randy picked out one, I picked out one. But they're book chapters that I think you'll find extremely interesting. One that I had recommended was The Accidental Universe, and the author is Alan Lightman. He was a professor at MIT in physics and in writing, in humanities, and then he has a similar position now at Harvard. Now, there aren't very many people at both of those two schools. He's the only professor that's ever had a joint appointment in physics and in humanities or in writing, which I thought was interesting. Okay, so what does science explain? What does nature explain? Let's begin with sort of putting out what I think are some traditional understanding about this. Thomas Aquinas in the 1300s, famous philosopher from the Catholic Church, and he basically postulated that religion or Christianity explores or explains the first or ultimate cause or agency as being God, okay? But then he went on to say that the secondary causes, things that we would call the laws of nature, okay, are the mechanisms that are the consequence of that first cause who put the universe together with all of its different amazing details. And so I think sometimes people get into trouble because they confuse agency. In our case, I'm using that as a sort of a philosophical term, but I'm really talking about the God of the Bible, okay? Agency with mechanism. And when you do that, you make all kinds of interesting mistakes. Put this down here where I can look at you and look down too. Science investigates natural, repeatable, observable phenomena to determine mechanism. And science is extraordinarily effective at doing that. What we've learned over the last 400 years, roughly, is testimony to that fact. Isaac Newton discovered mechanism when he first came to understand how planets orbit around the sun, and then developed a math to be able to describe those with a great deal of precision, which was later improved upon by Laplace. Newton understood the difference between mechanism and agency. He didn't think that God was in the mechanism. God was the one who created the mechanism. And he recognized that distinction between first cause and secondary causes. When Napoleon asked Laplace, who had later refined some of the early work that Newton had done to be able to explain everything. Newton's initial work didn't explain all the details. It explained generally well, but not all the details. And when Napoleon was shown this nice piece of work, he said, where is God in your theory? And he said, well, I don't have any need for God in my theory. He was basically saying, mechanism is a complete adequate explanation. Now, I would say that Napoleon just asked the wrong question. If he'd said, why is the universe with this kind of an amazing mechanism? That's a different question, right? God's not in the mechanism. God's the one that was ultimately the creator of and responsible for the mechanism. So you have to keep distinction between mechanism, that's what science is determining, and agency, which is the why is the universe the way it is. I like to think of the difference between what science explains and what religion explains in the following way. Our granddaughter comes in one morning and asks me, why is water boiling on the stove, Papa? And I said, well, it's like this. When you turn the switch, electrons run through the heating element and they bump into atoms, and they cause those atoms to vibrate more, and the ones at the bottom vibrate until they caused the bottom of the pan atoms to vibrate, and the ones at the bottom hit the ones next to them, and pretty soon that vibration goes up to the inside of the kettle. And then those begin to vibrate into the bottom of the water, and the water molecules vibrate, and eventually that transmits all the way up through the water, and eventually some of them are jumping off at the top, and we call that boiling water. Now, she looks like that's not very impressive at all. So she says, Mimi, why is the water boiling? She says, because we're making coffee. Now, which of those is right? Well, the answer is they're both right. But one is answering more the what's going on in the sense of how it happens, and the other, why it happens. Okay, and I think in general, science is very effective at explaining why things happen, but not very well at explaining how things happen. Francis Collins says, for example, that science is powerless to answer such questions as, why did the universe come into being? What is the meaning of human existence? What happens when we die? There are lots and lots of questions like that, which science is not so well able to answer. It's the purview of religion in particular to be able to address those kinds of questions. I want to mention scientism as well. Scientism is, I think, a problem sometimes we see today, and it can be something that is done by either people of religious beliefs who are maybe overly zealous, or people who are atheists and are overly zealous. But I think the scientific method itself doesn't have bias. It's a great way to understand patterns in nature. However, scientists sometimes do have biases. And we see that sometimes in the literature, particularly in the popular literature, when people are writing books, like Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion, takes the ideas that you could legitimately claim based on scientific data, but then he tries to make that data confess a lot more than what it appropriately says. He uses it to also try to explain things that simply are not in the right category. It's a category of confusions. One of the things I particularly like about the accidental universe, if you take the time to read the first chapter, you'll almost surely want to buy the book, because it's really as well written throughout as the first chapter. The one that happened to be important for our discussion today was then. But the thing that I appreciated about Alan Lightman was that he does a masterful job of letting the data do the talking. And when it comes to metaphysical implications, he's very honest about what his are and why he prefers this theory instead of that theory, not just on the basis of the data, but on the basis of his own metaphysical preferences. And I'm going to share something at the very end where he clearly makes that indication. And I appreciate, there's nothing wrong with having metaphysical ideas come from your observations in science, but it's important not to confuse those as necessarily being the derivative from science. In reading Alistair McGrath's book called The Fine-Tuned Universe, I became familiar with the term that's used in a very different way than I've seen it used before. When you think of abduction, what do you think of? Somebody got kidnapped, right? Now, I've looked long and hard in the dictionary to try to find the definition that would fit the way he uses the term, but he uses the term abduction to distinguish it from induction, okay, and deduction. And it's a distinctive form of logical inference that was developed many years ago by two different people at different times, Hansen and Pearson. The observations, and just to give you a brief idea of what this is about, the observations of some surprising or even astonishing phenomena, which is anomalous to existing ways of thinking, are made. A realization that these phenomena would not seem to be astonishing if a certain hypothesis were pertinent. There is therefore good reason for proposing that H proposal be considered to be correct. Now, notice it's saying proposes, okay? Because abduction, unlike induction and deduction, is not going to have the same authority simply because it's a speculative observation, a claim that's being made, but one that is supported primarily by the fact that it takes an astonishing, maybe very unexpected, difficult to explain ideas. It says, if this were true, then this wouldn't be astonishing. we would have a reason for believing that it's sudden. Okay? On the other hand, it's not like a more traditional scientific claim, which would be based on observations, induction to some sort of a hypothesis, make predictions, and then see if, in fact, you can experimentally confirm those. So it doesn't function in the same way, but when you're dealing with unique events, it may, in fact, be a good option. Oh, gosh. Sorry, I just hit the wrong key in the beginning of the presentation, so you can see it backwards real quick. Okay, so inference to the best explanation, what, as I said a minute ago, abduction is an alternative way of trying to deal with some of these kinds of interesting but difficult questions. So let me share with you very quickly four kinds of fine-tuning. I'm going to assume most of you already know the general ideas here, and if you haven't, please read your homework. If you'd read your homework, you would know this even better because the chapter Randy recommended was very detailed in going through this. The one I recommended went into it in part. But I'm going to share three things that I think are not just the constants for me that are evidence of fine-tuning. The mathematical form that nature takes, and the particular mathematical form that it takes. The values of the universal constants, which is normally what we talk about when we talk about fine-tuning. And then the fine-tuning of the initial conditions. Now, there's a fourth category here, which really doesn't fit exactly with the others, but I think is nevertheless interesting, and that's this whole issue of how unique is planet Earth in the grand scheme of things. There have certainly been a couple of very interesting books written recently, Rare Earth, and more recently one called Lucky Planet. It was written in 2013. Lucky Planet's quite different than Rare Earth in that it takes a very specific question. What does it take for the Earth to have a uniform temperature over its very long history? Not perfectly uniform, but sufficient that we have water able to exist in the liquid form. I shouldn't say that. I should say H2O exists in the liquid form. Water is the liquid form of H2O over a long period of time, which is an essential characteristic for life to develop and flourish. So these are all things that I find quite interesting. Okay, so just briefly, mathematical form that nature takes. Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, these all believe that the universe was orderly and described by mathematics because God fashioned it that way. Albert Einstein famously said, the most incomprehensible thing about our universe is its comprehensibility, its mathematical form. More in detail, Albert Einstein said the following, you may find it strange that I consider the comprehensibility of the world as a miracle or as an eternal mystery. Well, a priori, one would expect a chaotic world, which cannot be grasped by the mind in any way. A kind of orderly order created by Newton's theory of gravity, for example, for is wholly different. Even if man proposes the axioms of the theory, the success of such a project presupposes a high degree of ordering of the objective world. And this could not be expected a priori. That is the miracle which is being constantly reinforced as our knowledge explains. So the fact that the universe assumes a mathematical form is critically important. But beyond that, and I'm sorry, I said somehow I got two of these on there and I couldn't get them to go away with my trying to cancel them off. So that's the same slide or same picture twice. These are five of the basic laws of nature, and what's interesting is to say not only that the universe has mathematical form, but the specific mathematical form is extremely important. If it weren't for the Newtonian laws of mechanics and gravity, we would find today that we wouldn't have stars or planets. Okay, gravity is what causes the universe to condense into these interesting places and possibilities. If you look at Schrodinger's equation, and those of you who have a background in physics know that the whole periodic chart would not exist if that characteristic of nature was not there. I like to think of the laws of nature as not simply being these mathematical equations. I think it's the characteristics that God has built into and sustains in nature that lend themselves to being described with mathematical form. But it's the math that describes the equations, not the equations that force the universe to behave, okay? Some students get that backwards. But it's interesting that each of these fundamental laws, if we had more time, we could go into details and say, if the universe didn't have this particular characteristic, then the universe would not be a place where life could possibly happen. So it's not just that the laws of nature have a mathematical form. It's the specific characteristic of nature that they capture in their mathematical form that each one individually is essential to have a planet where life could exist. Okay, Paul Davies, commenting on this, says, all the evidence so far indicates that the many complex structures depend most delicately on the existing forms of these laws. It is tempting to believe, therefore, that a complex universe will emerge only if the laws of physics are close to what they are. The laws seem to be the product of exceedingly ingenious design. Okay, a second kind of fine-tuning, the one that people most often think of when they think of fine-tuning constants, in the design of the universe. There are many parameters in the universe that seem to be precisely tuned to allow for human existence. The book that came out in 1986, and I read it shortly after it came out and just found it to be fascinating, The Anthropic Cosmological Principle by Tipler and Barrow, goes through 100 different examples of different constants that are very essential, and if they vary slightly one way or the other, preclude the possibility of life. The constants I'm talking about are things like the speed of light, Planck's constant, Boltzmann's constant, the unit charge, the gravity force constant, the unit masses. There may be in the future some discovery of reasons why these have to be these certain values. They're functionally necessary, but the causal necessity is simply not clear. It appears that the speed of light could be anything, and the fact that it happens to be exactly what it is proves to be crucially important to having a universe where life might exist. Let me do this a little more quickly. Let me give just one example. The strength of the strong force is what allows the nucleus to be held together in a stable way. And if the strength of the strong force were slightly different by a couple of percent, one way or the other, then we would not have periodic chart. Periodic chart would look like, well, you can't see it on here. Let me see one more slide. Okay. So if the strong force, the nucleus was only 5% weaker, I'm sorry, or 2% stronger, we would have a periodic chart that looks like this, one element, hydrogen. Instead, because it is in that very, very narrow range where it must be to cause the nuclei to be stable, but not too stable, we end up with the possibility of all of these different kinds of atoms, much the same way Schrodinger's equation makes it possible to have atoms. So there's a lot of moving parts in making some of these things work. Just a second quick example. If you want to get the light from the sun to be carefully balanced for properly giving organic chemistry kinds of reactions, I want it to be enough to cause the reactions to occur, and I don't want it to be so much that it destroys all of the organic molecules. To stay in that narrow range, the two sides of this equation have to be satisfied, with the one on the left being slightly bigger than the one on the right. You'll notice there are six different universal constants in there. Notice that three of them are to the 12th power. And for the energy from the sun to be just what it needs to be for chemistry and life based on organic chemistry from carbon to occur, the term on the left has to be bigger than the term on the right. There's a threshold, but it can't be too much bigger. And if you take the actual values for those six constants and substitute them in, you'll find that they indeed are, the two sides of the equation are of approximately the same order of magnitude, or they are the same order of magnitude, and the one on the left is slightly bigger than the one on the right. So it's another of many, many examples of where the fine-tuning of the constants seems to be important. Paul Davies says there is, for me, powerful evidence that there is something going on behind it all. It seems as though somebody has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. Okay, a third kind of a fine-tuning has to do with the Big Bang, and there are other examples besides the Big Bang. When you first had the Big Bang, there's a critical problem here, because if the universe expands too fast, then there's not going to be the gravitational forces sufficient to cause condensation into stars and into planets. On the other hand, if it expands too slowly, then it's going to collapse on itself. Now, it turns out Stephen Hawking claims that if you were to change it by one part in 10 to the 10th, one way or the other, then you would not have it. The universe would have collapsed, or it would have expanded and never condensed into stars, into planets. So these are initial conditions. There's other many, many other such examples, but the universe ends up being a remarkable place. And then finally, if we talk about the Earth, which is the things that are brought up in Brownlee's book are not things that are fundamental laws of nature, but they're interesting, you might say, as they would say, accidents that are essential to have a planet suitable to support life. They, early in the book, writing, as both of them indicate that they're atheists, say, if some godlike, okay, being could be given the opportunity to plan a sequence of events with the express purpose of duplicating our Garden of Eden, that power would face a formidable task. It is unlikely that Earth could ever be truly duplicated. Okay, so how do we explain these four kinds of observations? Abduction, I think better, more clearly called inference to the best explanation is appropriate. These are remarkable things. You can look at them and say, well, here we are, and it's often the case you'll find people saying, the anthropic principle says, well, if all the things weren't just right, we wouldn't be here to be impressed, okay? And that's true, but it's sort of vacuous. It doesn't really give you any indication of why those things all happen to be that way. It's a truism. If things weren't just right, if the laws of nature weren't just right, the constants weren't just right, if the initial conditions weren't just right, then we would never have had complex conscious life to be impressed. But the fact that we are here is not an explanation of anything, okay? It's just a confirmation that the universe got it right. So it's not a proof, okay, and it's very provisional. It does not claim, okay, abduction, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead of myself. With regard to the observations we've made, that this is not a proof and it is very provisional. It does not claim that a more predictive explanation will not be discovered later, such as a theory of everything that Hawking often talks about. They will reduce the universe to a simple equation, or maybe a few equations, and constants that are necessary, not accidental. And that's been one of the grand hopes of cosmologists for a long time. But at this point in time, doesn't seem to be a solvable problem, at least not yet. Arnold Penzias, Nobel laureate, who discovered the background radiation for the Big Bang, notes, astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with the very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the right conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. So obviously Arnold Penzias and some other scientists are quick to say what we see today is certainly fair to infer as support for belief in God, not proof of, but evidence for. Okay, what are some other options here, though? There are some other options, and if you read the literature, I've had fun the last several months preparing to come up and do these several talks, doing a lot of catch-up reading of things that have happened just in the last several years. And it's interesting to see that probably the most popular alternative explanation to this phenomenal, what seems to be a remarkable set of coincidences, is the multi-universe idea. Most of you, if you follow this at all, know the multi-universe is, there actually isn't a multi-universe theory, there are multiple ones, but let's say based on string theory and other things, predict that the universe might have as many as 10 raised to the 500th power of other universes. Okay? And if there were that many universes, then you would say, well, I've got enough probabilistic resources that even though what has to happen is extremely improbable, if I only get one roll of the dice, I'm out of luck, almost surely. But if I get 10 to the 5th roll, 10 to the 500th roll of the rolls of the dice, then in fact, that's not surprising at all. And I think that's a fair point. Now, the question is, how reasonable is it that we really are going to find that the universe does indeed tend to the 500th other universes, okay? So that's one possibility. Obviously, a intelligent creator would be another solution, the one that I've been poisoning up until now. I think there are two problems with resolving fine-tuning with the multiverse, and the first one is, I think, well described in a recent article on this multi-universe theory in the New York Times editorial page called A Crisis at the Edge of Physics, Science Without Experimental Confirmation. Okay. If one creates a multi-universe model, it involves mathematics, it involves equations, it involves specially chosen constants to get the desired result. And let's suppose that with time we were able to somehow be able to experimentally confirm the multi-universe. The complaint here is that it's all theory, it's all elegant theory, but it doesn't seem right now to be a direct way to confirm it, because you can't look out of our own universe. I had a nice opportunity last night at Brown University to talk to a guy who does experimental astronomy and cosmology. And he says, well, we're hoping that we can see maybe the effect of these other universes on our universe. And if that effect were big enough, then we might be able to infer their other universes by the influence that they have. But he says right now, it's a long time away and it's a really hard problem. And I asked him what he thought about all of the postulating having to do with this as an experimentalist. And he said what a lot of my friends in physics say. The theorists think it really is elegant and beautiful, and the experimentalists say, show me the data, okay? Show me the data. Otherwise, it really is a matter of faith that you believe in that. But let's suppose that they did finally show there is a large number of universes, and string theory or something like it is a way of predicting how that happened. Would that necessarily say, well, it must be string theory and not God? I don't think so. Because the alternative is string theory itself involves what? A universe. It's describing the mathematical forms that are very particular. It will have constants in it. It does have constants in it that require very precision values. And the net result is it's not solving the problem, it's just pushing it down one more level. You're going to have the same fundamental kinds of issues that we have with trying to explain it at the level that we work at today outside of string theory. Okay, so let me just conclude with the choices that we have. I think we can believe in an intentional universe with a creator. A universe created, not creator. Intentional universe created with a purpose. Okay. A second possibility is a multi-universe, which makes accidental universe with solar systems, planets, and Earth in that solar system that are statistically plausible, but it happened by accident. That's why Alan Lightman calls his book The Accidental Universe, okay? That's why he calls it The Accidental Universe. Third possibility is the grand theory of everything that has been today very elusive and may or may not be found in the future. Now, let me just finish by reading one short segment from your reading assignment. This is from the end of the first chapter. Alan says, that uncertainty also disturbs many physicists who are adjusting to the idea of the multiverse. He's talking about the lack of experimental confirmation. Not only must we accept that basic properties of our universe are accidental and uncalculatable, in addition, we must believe in the existence of many other universes. We have no conceivable way of observing these other universes, and cannot prove their existence. Thus, to explain what we see in the world and in our mental deductions, we must believe in what we cannot prove. Okay? Sound familiar? Theologians are accustomed to taking such beliefs on faith. Scientists are not. Such arguments, in fact, run hard against the long grain of science. All we can do is hope that some same theories that predict the universe, the multiverse, will also make other predictions that we can test here in our local universe. But the other universes themselves will almost certainly remain a conjecture. Now, in the book, in multiple places, he says, I really find the fine-tuning argument very challenging to dismiss. And he says, I have problems with the multi-universe, but I prefer it. Why? Because I'm an atheist. And it's a better solution. But he acknowledges that it's not a really scientific solution at this point in time. So what I like about him is he says, I really prefer the multi-universe, but I realize that it's a matter of faith. I'm taking that step of faith. Why? Because I'm an atheist. And if people happen to think the fine-tuning proves that there's a God, they may be taking their own step of faith. At this point, there's maybe not a final resolution of that, but I appreciate an author who will be that honest. So let me stop here so I don't encroach on Randy's time. Thank you for your time and attention.